certainly a lot of physics in southwestern Ontario, I guess. So I'm going to tell you about some recent ideas and work in progress on thinking about rather conventional physics of the D-wave superconductors, mainly referring, in fact, exclusively referring to the Holdo systems. This is work in collaboration with, actually there's some, as you'll see, some rather high power RG computations that went into this. They were done exclusively by Andrea Pellicetto and Ettore Vicari, people I actually have never met, who work on high loop computations in field theories. And the part that we're going to contribute to talk about today is done in collaboration with a second year student, Yi-Chin He. Okay, so to remind you, this is a spectrum of the electronic excitations in the D-wave, in the qubit superconductors. So I'll begin with a survey of some experiments that I'm interested in understanding. So you have a Fermi surface in the Holdo system here. The electrons are over here. Then when the system goes superconducting, it develops a gap on this Fermi surface. And this is the, along this line, this is the spectrum of excitations. It vanishes at this point right there linearly. And so the points at which this, the electronic spectrum go to zero energy are called the nodal points, and they're labeled here in the blue line zone. This point here is the same as that point. And this comes, of course, just a quick reminder from the chalk. Here we go. So the spectrum in a BCS state of quasiparticles, let's just quickly remind you, is the dispersion of the electrons in the absence of any pairing plus some delta k squared, and that's what you're plotting up there. So this Fermi surface is over here, and this dependence here comes from the vanishing of the pairing amplitude at along these lines, because delta k is cosine kx minus cosine ky. Okay. All right. So this has been known for quite a while, and this is, you know, some of the early experiments showing quite conclusively that you have D-wave superconductivity in the whole group of cuprates. So people now have been studying these excitations more closely, looking at the temperature and frequency and wave vector dependence of the electron spectral function near these points. So here I'm going to show you, there's quite a bit of data. I'm going to show you some recent work from the PSI group, who, you know, again, these are the nodal points. They're looking at the spectrum at a variety of lines near the nodal points. And this is what you see as a function of energy and wave vector in what I call the energy distribution cut and the momentum distribution cut. So here you, let's see, so it's color-coded, and I hope I get this right. So this is the Fermi energy there. And right on the Fermi energy as a function of energy at different wave vectors, you get, you know, rather sharp peak, and as you see, the peak disperses, but as it disperses, it also becomes broader. And a similar thing is happening in the momentum distribution function, where it's a little clearer right at the Fermi level. So this sharp peak, this wave vector here is that wave vector. You have a very sharp quasiparticle, and it becomes broader. This is at low temperatures, near at 14% doping. Okay. So now you could take, it's easier, I guess, because the line shapes are simpler to do it in the momentum distribution function. You could take the width of these peaks and plot them as a function of energy along this direction. And what you see really quite clearly, well, I don't know, depends how, is that, roughly speaking, the width goes linearly with the energy. I'm not going to say anything about these kinks. That's a very fairly high energy feature. I want to focus on this linear energy dependence at low energies. So if you had a conventional BCS superconductor, what would you expect for this width to do? Well, if you had just an ordinary Fermi surface, let's see, if this is the Fermi surface here, if you had a Fermi liquid with these states occupied, then if you look at the lifetime or the width of the particles near the at the Fermi energy, it goes as E squared. That's the canonical result of Fermi liquid theory. Now, in a D-wave superconductor with any kind of arbitrary sets of interaction, if you have nodal points, so you have this dispersion, so the dispersion, so this is a Fermi liquid. If you have a nodal point with this conical dispersion at this point, so this thing right near the nodal point becomes basically kx square root of kx squared plus ky squared, where kx and ky are measured from this point. Then, so you see that when you gap out the Fermi surface, you have even fewer low energy excitation to scatter into. And so just from phase space considerations, you would conclude that gamma should go as E cubed in a D-wave superconductor. So this is the issue I want to understand, one of the issues. Where is this very large line width coming from? There's also some interesting temperature dependence and frequency dependence on the shape of the spectral flux in this direction, the so-called Fermi arcs that you may have heard about. Our theory will also have something to say about that, but let's just focus on the width for now. Okay, so that's the question I want to ask. Fairly well posed question, and there's a variety of experiments that show this. In fact, just remember, there's another experiment also very recently by Seamus Davis. This is not on LISCO, but on BISCO, where he's measured the, again, the same spectral function, but now without momentum resolution on various spots on the BISCO surface. So if you take the BCS prediction, which just comes from this dispersion spectrum, you would get the spectrum without the gamma 2, the imaginary part. So and these are spectra at different points in the sample. So he sees this inhomogeneous superconducting state with so-called large gap and small gap regions, and these are spectra as a function of energy at different points. And what you see here is that you get a rather very nice fit of the low energy behavior with this functional form, where they take gamma 2 of E to be proportional to E again. So again, right at low energies, it seems like you need damping or widths of order E to understand the data, and this is also at very low temperatures. So that's how, that's the puzzle that I want to address. So I'm going to address it from, again, in a fairly conventional point of view. I'm going to say, well, this is obviously there must be some low energy scattering, some other collective mode here. And I'm going to look for, search for, in fact, we do an exhaustive search for any possible conventional order parameter that having to do with some kind of broken symmetry, really. That could possibly explain this. And we'll see that it comes out in the end, it is almost, there's essentially only one answer. And we'll see what it is. So here's another way to put it. So one way you could get gamma of E proportional to E is simply gamma of E proportional to E is a very characteristic behavior at any quantum critical point. And very crudely speaking, it's just kind of a scaling. So if you're at a critical point, then you're scale invariant. So there's no natural scale for the problem. And if you measure the line width, which is an energy, well, the only thing it could be is energy with some proportionality constant, which in principle would be universal. So that's an almost trivial argument, also fair, but it's also quite a deep argument. It's a property of a strongly coupled quantum critical point. Now, yes, okay, that's fine. That should work. But there's another ingredient that's important, which is what's emphasized here, is that this critical theory should involve in the nodal quasiparticle. It can't be a theory in some order parameter out there, which is decoupled from the nodal quasiparticles. That goes critical, that's fine, but why should the nodal quasiparticles care? That's really the key issue. How can you get a critical point which the nodal quasiparticles care about? They're not weakly coupled to it, and that would be one way of getting line widths of this order. And I'm going to explore some of the possibilities today. All right. Okay, so let's now change gears and talk about some other experiments. What are the candidate order parameters? So of course, especially in LSCO, which I'm mainly going to focus on, there's rather good indication that there is another ordering going on as a function of hole doping. I'll show you the phase diagram in a minute. And that's comes from neutron scattering and muon spin resonance, that you have these low energy spin excitation. So this is as a function of energy and wave vector of the what is being plotted as is the locus of sharp peaks of high energy scattering of large cross section scattering of neutrons, which you can then read off as some sort of dispersion of some underlying excitation. So what you're doing here as you're moving in this axis is you're near the pi point, and you're moving along this axis or this axis. Suppose of the experiment. And these are data from a variety of samples, and YVCO also behaves somewhat similarly. And what you see in terms of dispersion is, of course, there's some high energy part that I won't have much to say about. But at low energies, there seems to be long range order, at least a large spin correlation length, lots of excitations at this wave vector here, which are labeled for the moment points K. So that's near at least 1/8 doping, there is some kind of spin density wave order, some spin correlations becoming large at this wave vector K. So that's the order parameter I want to focus on. Well, not exclusively, but we'll see they'll play an important role in many of the things I'm going to say. So here's another picture of that same data where you can actually enhance that spin density wave order by a magnetic field. This is a somewhat older experiment. So these four points here are the same as those four points over there, which is the same as these points here. So now, you know, you can do elastic scattering and look at the structure factor at these wave vectors, and you get correlation lengths of 70, 80 angstroms, I think, in the best LSCO samples. But what Lake et al. Showed a while back is that now if you apply a magnetic field, then in a field, this order got enhanced. You got even more scattering at low energies in a field. This is the field-induced signal. I believe that you can understand this through a phase diagram sort of like this that we predicted a while back. So this axis is doping. And at high doping, you have an ordinary superconducting state, this D-wave superconductor I'm discussing. And we assume here that there's some critical point below which you get the spin density wave order forming. Now, the system, of course, has disorder and many other complications in this idealized model that we looked at. We just said, well, let's assume there's a state here where you have coexisting superconductivity and spin density wave order. Then what would happen in a magnetic field? So that's on the x-axis. Well, if you apply a magnetic field, we argue that these low energy excitations above the spin excitations above the superconducting state would become even lower in energy, following the formula. And eventually along this line here, they're going to reach zero energy. And so you'd have a transition along this line from a superconducting state to a state with long range spin density wave order. So the experiment of Lake et al. In this configuration when they have, you know, elastic scattering already at zero field is somewhere over here, and it gets enhanced in large field in as you apply a field according to this formula that we predicted. And there are subsequent experiments by Kekovich and the MIT group who have looked at LSCO samples here, and then they see an onset of elastic scattering above a critical field. Okay, so in this, at least in LSCO, then there's some evidence, I would say, of this critical point, and what I'm going to focus on in the first part of my talk is what effect does this critical point have on the nodal quasiparticle. So you're going to go from a superconducting state to a state with a coexisting spin density wave order. Actually, very recently there's been muon, muSR, and neutron scattering experiments also by the PSI group, where they have mapped out this color plot is the moment is the static moment as measured in muSR, I believe. And so in the superconductor, there's no moment. And at below 8th doping, there is a moment. And this line is, you know, roughly consistent with the predictions. And so there's a critical point where the moment vanishes and that point moves up in doping in the field. So again, there's that critical point that I'm going to focus on. Okay. So I guess just for the non-experts, maybe I should. Well, I realized one thing I didn't do is actually show a picture of the state that I'm talking about. So what am I? What is this order parameter more practically? What do I mean by this order? Well, it's you have the square lattice, and the spin density wave ordering is that some wave vector which is about 1/8 away from pi pi, and basically it corresponds to the spins. Here the spins are polarized, and you get a they kind of oscillate with a period of 8 lattice spacings with a short oscillation of pi vector. So it's something like this, so on. Okay, so there's an envelope of 8 lattice spacing that's imposed on the short range nail order at pi pi. That's the ordered state we're talking about, which there's quite a bit of evidence in LSCO.
Sure, where you have
No, it is. This is the I'm distinguishing that from what's called the spiral picture. So you can get two possible ways of getting incommensurate spin density wave order. You could have this pi pi order, you start with it, and then it could start spiraling.
Right.
And that's not stripes. I mean, if you spiral, then you don't have then the length of the moment on each side is the same.
Right, but in the stripe picture, you'd have regions that are locally a pi pi type ordering, just
Yeah.
simple anti-ferromagnet, and then it skips.
That's rather an extreme version of this. It's but qualitatively the same thing. There is another distinction, which is distinction between bond centering and site centering. Is that what you're referring to?
No, I just
No, that's so maybe another picture. Yeah, okay. It's good to figure this out. So the conventional stripe picture that Bruce was referring to would correspond to, this is not, I mean, it's slightly different from it. You get, okay, so say you've got some anti-ferromagnet, then you have a hole, and then you have, you skip a period.
Right.
Okay. This is also a spin density wave of period 8. It's not, a, it's, you know, if I draw this, I would draw this something like this. And if you just take that square wave and make it a cosine, then you get it's the same thing. But there's another state, so this is allowed. I mean, it's just a question of how sharp, how many harmonics you have. Is it a, in fact, from the experiments, you only see one harmonic. So it's really not a square wave in the experiment. It is more like the picture I drew. The other possibility is the following state. Where you can imagine something like this, and then you have holes spread out a bit more, but you have again the phase shift, so this becomes like this, and then holes here. This is also a period 8 state, and the difference here is that the envelope has a zero on the bond and not on the site. Here the zero is on the site. And here the zeros on the bond. I would say that the recent, if I take the BISCO experiment with Seamus Davis, they're much more like this. He just did a paper in Science where he talked about bond center charge order. And this also is consistent with our kind of valence bond picture. So you can imagine this is really a valence bond here, and the holes. So I think the, now, Peter Almamonte with X-ray kinetic principle distinguished these two, but I don't think he's categorically said one way or the other, which one it is. But these are the states of thought.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Is this low energy mode always observed around 1/8 doping, or it's different in other practices?
Well, it's most clearly seen in LSCO. But so this umbrella spectrum is kind of is seen in, I think, YBCO and the whole thing of work. The difference is in YBCO, you only see points up to here. I think that green points may well be YBCO in this picture. They don't really come down all the way there. They're a bit higher. In BISCO, and the res what people call a resonance mode is this sharp excitation right here. In BISCO, there's some indication of this resonance mode. I don't think people have really seen the downturn. Okay. But in LSU is where you really see things down here. Right, so this is experimental data here. It looks such a pretty plot, which I like very much. This is just the data of the moment as measured in USR. Okay, so that's this kind of spin density wave slash stripe order is what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about its coupling to the nodal cost part. That's the question I'm going to address. But as you'll see, there's going to be another order parameter that will kind of almost be forced upon us, which we've also had, and Kibelson especially has thought about quite a bit, and Kibelson and Fradkin, which is this pneumatic. Oh, before I go ahead, sorry. All right, so let me just continue with this order parameter a bit. Oh, sorry, forgot this. Okay, change the train of thought. So I've talked to you about this spin density wave ordering parameter. And as I said, I want to think about how did this couple to the nodal quasiparticles. So here's one of the key points, just by looking at the Brillouin zone again. So these quasiparticles I showed you are these pink regions here. That's where you have low energy fermionic excitations. And the spin density wave order, or the stripe order that I showed you, is at this wave vector k, which is way over there, one of these bovines. So if a low energy excitation come along and scatters the nodal quasiparticles, what is it going to do? Well, of course, you have to conserve energy and momentum. And energy is no problem. Well, and you find that immediately there's a problem, I guess. If you conserve momentum, well, then you're going to go from this point to some point over there, maybe a little angle. But you will definitely not end up at this other quasiparticle. So if you conserve momentum, you can't conserve energy because this thing carries low energy. These nodal quasiparticles have low energy. But there's nothing there. There's no fermion excitation there with low energy. So there's really, you know, naively you would say, well, the quasiparticles in the spin density wave order just can live independently of each other. There's some virtual scattering between them, but there's nothing singular. Because of this problem with energy and momentum conservation. So that's kind of the heart of the problem that I'm addressing here, which many people are aware of. You know, how is it that, okay. And in some ways, it's also a good thing because, you know, the whole stripe picture makes no reference to nodal quasiparticles. And this is why you can get away with it, because they're really quite independent. Okay. Now, another set of experiments, also from last year, this time in YVCO, by the Stuttgart group, Stuttgart and Paris, Keimer and Hinkoff and Philippe Bouge and others. So they're looking at the same spectrum here, now in a somewhat different picture. So what's being, well, this is a rather busy plot, especially for a talk. And I'm still not fully convinced by the data, but anyway. So what are we seeing here? These are plots as a function of wave vector of neutron scattering. Let's focus on these red lines, on which color, which is the lowest temperatures, the black squares. So let's focus on the black squares. So at very low energies, not that low energies, if you see this, the double peak structure. What is that? Well, this is going back here. I should have put this plot over here. That's going across this way. So as you go across this way, you're going to see a peak when you cross this, and another peak as you cross that. And then the other plots go higher and higher energies. And so what you can see is that initially these peaks will come together. You'll get one large peak here. And then you're going to get two peaks moving away. So they're going to come together and move away. And that's what you see also. You clearly see that in LSCO. And you see that in YVCO also. Just focus on the black squares. So they come together, there's one peak, then they move away again at higher energy. Now what the important thing about this experiment is that it was done in a single domain. It was D-twin sample of YVCO. And they looked at the difference between going along the X direction and going along the Y direction. So previously we paid no attention to that. And if you look, so this column is on the X direction, the others go on the Y direction. So again, in terms of this picture here, they're going in one column this way, the other column that way. Okay, so if you look on this column on the y direction, then you see a roughly similar structure. You can see a peak here that disappears and then broadens again as you go to higher frequencies. Okay, so that's in the superconducting state. But what they point out is that if you look in the normal state above TC, or the pseudo-gap state, sorry, you see something rather different. And in that pseudo-gap state are the red lines. Along one direction, you know, you see these double peak structure, which basically stays there. They don't ever come together. It stays at all frequencies, just looking at the red line. Okay. I tried not to look at the red line, but looked at the actual data, and it's not as convincing from the data. But if you just look at the red line, it's totally convincing. on the other hand, if you look at the red lines on the y direction, nothing like that happens. Well, in fact, at low energies, there's no splitting at all. But at high energies, it's the same on the x and y direction. Anyway, the claim by the experimentalist is, you know, I'm sure there are good reasons for it, although just looking at the plots, I'm not entirely convinced, but I haven't talked to them, is that there is clearly in the pseudo-gap state, in a deuterium sample, an anisotropy that the sample on its own in the pseudo-gap state seems to like x better than y. The spin excitation along the x direction are different from the spin excitations along the y direction. Actually, that is really quite clearly shown, but there is a difference. You may argue about the details of what the difference is. Right. And that difference is temperature dependent. So, you know, there's a small hole in the argument. YBCO is not a perfect tetragonal crystal. It's got these chains. And so you would expect a difference anyway. But it's all strongly temperature dependent. And so it does seem like an intrinsic property. It'd be, of course, nice to do this experiment in a, you know, tetragonal sample, single domain tetragonal sample, but I don't think we have good enough samples to do that. Okay, so what's emerging here is what Kivelson and Fradkin and Emery have called nematic order, which is kind of a cousin of the stripe order, as you can see. So I drew these stripes here, and I drew the stripes in the x direction, and then you can also imagine stripes in the y direction. And what this seems to suggest, these kind of experiments, is that this difference between x and y, you know, could develop before the system really decides to have any spin density of order. That's really, these fluctuations in the x and y directions could be another order property you have to worry about. Just fluctuations locally between orthorhombic and tetragonal symmetry. Yeah.
From transport for this anisotropy being temperature dependent in a similar way to what they find, like, you know, if you do resistivity in X and Y, you know.
I think there is.
Yeah, Ando's group, LSCL, has done a very nice measurement of that sort.
I mean, but the point is, if you had spin density with water, you would also expect it. Okay. The question really is there anisotropy without spin density? That is, the spins are not quite ordered, but still they've just chosen between x and y. That would be in the true nematic state. And here it's clear the spins have an order, so that's why this is a little more significant. Okay, any more questions on my selective review of some recent data? Okay, so that's almost half the time. Great, so now I'm going to start my talk. Oh, that's good. That's exactly what I wanted to do. So I'm going to talk about some theory now, which are motivated by all these observations. Okay, so first let's begin with just talking about this simplest transition between a superconductor to a superconductor with coexisting spin density wave order. So how would you write down a theory for this? So this is the critical point I want to talk about. Ignoring disorder, but everything else we're going to include eventually. The superconducting fluctuations, the nodal quasi-particles, really a complete theory, which I'm quite happy about. all right, so we want to talk about such a transition. So first thing you want to do is write down an order parameter. So the spin operator, the electron spin at a site, I'll write down in terms of these two waves. There's one wave, which is the wave vector k1. Now I'm going to distinguish between these four points. There's really two inequivalent points, k1 and k2, one along the x and the other on the y direction. I is the spin component, goes from 1, 2, 3. And I have a wave moving along the one direction and another one moving along the y direction. So there's two amplitudes here, phi 1 and phi 2. And furthermore, these amplitudes are complex numbers. So there's, you know, they are, the reason they're complex is that this wave has also a phase degree of freedom. It may be discrete, but that it's enough. You can move this whole thing over by one lattice spacing, and that gives you the same state. So that changes the phase of phi by pi by 2, I think, or no, pi by 4. And so there is, you can also keep changing the phase of phi, and at least in the theory we're going to work with, you can imagine it's even incommensurate. And so there's an arbitrary sliding degree of freedom along the x direction. So you have three complex numbers here, three complex numbers here, a total of 12 real numbers that characterize this ordering transition. And we want to look at a general theory consistent with all the symmetries of these 12 fields. It's a very conventional kind of thing, but it still quite has a lot of structure. Okay, so now we're going to write down some low energy theory for this. Okay, this is the most general quartic Hamiltonian. Okay, don't have to pay attention to all the details. So the way it works is that you have these two complex vectors, and you look at what happens to them under the various symmetry operations of the square lattice. It's translation in the x direction, translations in y, rotations by 90 degrees, inversion and time reversal. So the set of operations and how they act on this order parameter. And consistent with these symmetries, you just write down all possible terms. So it's basically a Landau-Ginzburg theory with a bunch of spatial and temporal gradients. Then there's the usual phi squared terms that tune you across the transition. And then the complicated thing is that there are five possible quartic fourth order terms. And all of these have some physical meaning. They really select among all the different possible ordered states you could form. All right, so the next step is to take this theory and find its fixed point. So do the Wilson-Fisher analysis. You know, the usual Wilson-Fisher analysis of the Ising model, you know, looking back today, it's, you know, you can do it in half an hour. It's just a matter of doing the one loop calculation and finding this Wilson-Fisher fixed point, where you have one quartic coupling. So now you have five quartic couplings. Yeah, Anton.
Does not enter here.
Yeah, so it does enter both, so there's superflow fluctuations. They can't, you in principle do have to put in those terms that happen. So you take your superconducting order parameter called psi. Well, the most important part of it are these superflow terms. And you can get a term like d tau theta times mod phi squared. And then you can do a scaling argument and show that those don't matter as long as nu is greater than 1. Nu is greater than 2/3, and which will in the end will turn out fixed. Okay, that's sort of technical, but yes, you can show that that's not important. Actually, once you allow for the Coulomb interaction, it's definitely not important because the plasma mode will lift this up. What will be more important is the node required part. That will come to it. Okay, so now, you know, again, there's been 20 years of work in looking at these multi-component 5-4 field theory. It's really been quite a long controversy. Some of you working on spirally ordered states and triangular lattice may know about, you know, Kawamura fixed point and lots of other things. But I think there's now quite some good understanding of how to do this and what are the results you get. And a large part of it is due to work by I'm jumping ahead again. Before I get to analyzing this, it'll be very important in subsequently to really understand what the symmetries of this theory are. So there's a variety of symmetries here, which are all very physical. There's a symmetry of sliding the stripe along the x direction, which is a continuous symmetry. So that's the phase U1 symmetry. It's sliding the stripe in the y direction, rotating the stripe by 90 degrees. That's Z4. And then spin rotation. So this is the symmetry group of this theory. Okay, so now we want to do some RG analysis. I hope that's the next transparency. Yes. And a lot of the progress in the multi-component theories has been due to the group of Vicari in PISA and various collaborators. And so when you know, they saw our paper, they decided to turn up the crank, and they did a six-loop RG analysis. This is definitely state of the art, not to be done taken lightly. And it really, why six loops? You would say, well, it turns out that even for things like spiral order in one direction of the triangle lattice, which is an old problem, it really takes that much to get the answer to converge. Now there's been lots of checks using numerics that their fixed points really are there. So there's two different six loop and one six loop and one five loop analysis.
The lower story group expansion that breaks down here physically, like why do you have to go as what that, where is the marginality in that theory?
Oh, well, you do the lowest order terms and you just find things going off infinity. You don't, the lowest one loop calculation gives you no well defined fixed point in the right regime of parameters that you want it to get the spirally order state. I mean, to get the strike state. I mean, just a question of numbers. It just doesn't, epsilon equals one is not small. All right, so you're going to do an epsilon expansion for epsilon equals one. I should say this is not just six loop. This is a Borel resum. You know the large order behavior, and you do these resummations. So this requires some serious work. And they're the experts.
I should believe the results.
Yeah, absolutely. You should believe the results.
And then six loops is enough.
Right. So okay. I'm giving the wrong impression. So, so as I said, in a simpler problem, but closely related problem, there's been 20 years of work on this, and now everyone seems to be converging on this. What the right answer is? These two different apps. There's a five loop, two different six loop expansion, and another five loop expansion by different renormalization methods. There's a variety of numerical studies, and they're all consistent, giving you a consistent picture. For this particular problem, there's no numerics, right? So, but I'm pretty confident they know what they're doing. right. Anyway, so they get some fixed point, and the fixed point, has some. Remember I showed you these five quartic couplings. Well, all those couplings obey certain relations at the fixed point. This is the fixed point that you find, and when you go to these fixed point couplings, you find the theory is in fact. I told you the symmetry about this thing, U1 cross Z4 cross O3. Well, this fixed point, in fact, turns out to have a bigger symmetry. It's O4 cross O3. And what does this all mean? Well, one way you can imagine, see how you get this O4 is you take your two complex vectors and write it in terms of real vectors. So you have four three-component vectors. The I index is the spin index. So you have four vectors. And there's a space of four dimensional rotations, which becomes exact at the fixed point. So another way to say it is that this is the symmetry. You have symmetry of x translations, symmetry of y translations, symmetry of 90-degree rotations. And those symmetries all become, combine into a much larger symmetry. So there's an emergent symmetry right at the critical point. It moves away the moment you move away from the critical point, and you go into one of these order states. Okay, so why do I care about the symmetry? I don't really care about the symmetry, but it's what comes out from this computation. And what are some of its consequences? Well, there's one very interesting consequence, is that a whole bunch of order parameters, suppose I'm now coming to the superconductor side, and looking at various fluctuations. One natural fluctuation you may want to look at are the charge density wave fluctuations. The charge density waves will be in as any stripe at wave vectors 2k1 and 2k2, and the order parameters are the square of the spin density wave order parameter. You can also add on charge density waves along the diagonals, phi 1 times phi 2 or phi 1 star times phi 2. And finally, you can also write down this pneumatic order parameter, phi, which is do you have a charge density wave in the x direction, in which case phi 1 is large, or do you have it in the y direction, in case phi 2 is large? You can take the difference of the squares, that gives you this Ising order parameter telling you about the Z4 symmetry break. So all of these order parameters become equivalent, they're as strong, equally strong near the critical point. So if you look at the susceptibility on the superconducting side, You're looking at, not static order, you're looking at the fluctuations of charge density wave and the Ising order. They diverge with the same exponent, gamma bar, which we've computed in a recent paper. So it's a rather strong divergence. And these are the strongest sort of other order parameters that appear on the superconducting side. So this is an important prediction of this theory. So far, as far as I know, people haven't really seen, I mean, at least Peter Albamonte, when I talked to him, said they've seen static charge order, but they haven't seen fluctuating charge order in the superconducting site above an eighth doping. But maybe they will someday, and if they do, you have a non-trivial prediction that you've seen them both along the at 2K1, 2K2, but also along the diagonals. That's really sticking my neck out, but okay. All right, so let's go back to the main story now. Let's go back to putting in the nodal quasiparticle. So that's how I've now described the current status of this theory, already quite complicated and really took state-of-the-art work to understand, ignoring the nodal quasiparticle. So now I'm going to add the nodal quasiparticles to this theory. All right, so I've already shown you the theory for the spin density wave order. Now I have to put back in another set of excitations, these fermions. So these fermions vanish in energy at these 4 points in Willouin zone. So field theoretically, you write them down. You have two fermions, I call them psi1 and psi2. Psi1 is a four-component fermion corresponding to the up and down component of the electrons at these 2 points. And similarly, psi2 is a four-component thing on those 2 points. And near these points, their energy changes linearly, along this direction, along the diagonal, you have a Fermi velocity. And along this direction, you have V delta. That's the slope of the gap. That's this slope here of the D wave parent. So you have a Fermi velocity along this direction, and then a V delta along that direction, which is this thing. And this will give you the conical spectrum. So at low energies, this theory would, at least in terms of the dispersion, agree very well with the photo emission. The question is now, how can I put these two theories together and get the line widths to work out? So as I said, in more formal terms, you can't really get them to couple, you would think naively. Because of this energy conservation problem, you scatter a psi1 with a phi, it'll end up here, which is not really a low energy excitation. So there's no, in field theoretical terms, there's no trilinear couplings or Yukawa coupling between your scalar and your two fermions. It's just prohibited by all the symmetries. But okay, say there's no Yukawa coupling, let's go one higher order. That's really all we said. What about a second order process, kind of like a Raman process, if you wish, is you can have your phi come in, scatter to some virtual fermion state here, and then come back. This can be in resonance. And also obey momentum conservation, but it's just a higher order term. So the second order process, but it could affect things. And this would be a term of this type. You have two actions of phi, so there's one phi here and another phi here, and then psi right psi. What can this term do? That's really all we ask. We ask that simple question. And what comes out? Well, you have to now, of course, do a more careful job. You have to figure out what the terms are. So one way to do it is to really sit down with the D wave Hamiltonian and do this Raman scattering calculation. it will involve all these virtual states. It's not easy. And beyond my ability, so we just said you actually figure everything out by symmetry. So just apply symmetry. I know the action of everything on symmetry. Just look for all general terms consistent with the symmetry. Turns out there's only three, which are of this structure, which have obey momentum and energy conservation correctly. I mean, really, what symmetry is doing is getting momentum conservation for you by translation invariance. So there's one term like this, which is mod phi1 squared plus mod phi2 squared, which is basically the energy of the superconducting fluctuations, of the spin density wave fluctuations. And this is just the energy operator for the nodal quasiparticle. So it's the energy of one of the fermions will couple with the energy of the spin density. This kind of a trivial coupling has to be there. Okay, that's good. That's one term. The second term, it will turn out to be the key one, you know, but we just bet in on all possible terms. This is the pneumatic order parameter, which is saying that the spin density waves could decide to be either on the X or the Y. And that decision is represented by the value of this number. And similarly, now what is the other thing? Well, the D wave superconductor is pure D wave, but for a while it could decide to be D plus S or D minus S. So what I mean by that is that if I look at the, I bring that tall enough. Okay. These Canadians are very tall, huh? That's okay. All right. There we go. So you're at the D wave points. So if X was slightly different from Y, then you could imagine these points, you know, could move here. Suppose they did that. So they went from tetragonal to orthorhombic. And so that's like mixing in a virtual S pairing amplitude. And that's exactly what made X different from Y. So if you had a striped superconductor, it's really not pure D wave. It has to be D plus S. And this is a term that would move the nodal points a little bit in the X along one of the two directions. So that's the coupling. These are tetragonal to orthorhombic fluctuations in the spin density wave. And these are the D to D plus S fluctuations, and they couple to each other. 5 minutes? Oh. All right, great. And then finally, there's another coupling. This is like a spiral spin order coupling to spiral spin order. This is the only thing that's allowed. So these are the three things that are allowed with the second order virtual effects. So what we can do, or at least I called up my Italian friends and said, here are the three couplings. Do the five loop calculation of the scaling dimension of this coupling. And within a couple of weeks, they came back. I mean, they gave me the answers. And look at the answers here. So they gave you the dimension at the decoupled fixed point of these three operators. So if this is positive, that means that coupling is important. It's going to really scatter strongly. If it's negative, it means it's irrelevant. And if it's zero, that means the system is critical. That's, you want it to be close to zero. That's what you want, because that's what's going to give you line widths E going in E. You want something to be critical. And what you find is that, well, the energy coupling is irrelevant, the spiral coupling is irrelevant, but the pneumatic coupling is very close to zero. You know, within, can't even, the uncertainty is larger than the value, but it's probably a little negative, but it's close to zero. So, you know, what do I judge the significance of this? So what this means is that really, if I look at the line width, if you work out the line width from this theory, it's going to be E to the power of one, or suppose it's minus 0.5 plus 0.05. Well, you couldn't possibly tell that difference, you know, over, you know, that's a very, very, that kind of exponent is impossible to tell. And so this is great. So this is exactly the coupling that could, this comes out of the blue. We didn't put any bias. It's this pneumatic. These orthorhombic and tetragonal fluctuations seem to be the ones that can in fact give you line widths of order E. Yes, exactly. They're decoupled because it's negative. If it goes positive, then you have to do much more work. All right, I'm out of time. Okay, well, so that's the main fluctuation. Let me very quickly talk about the third part. This is working with Yi-Jin He and also in collaboration with Steve Kibbleson, Eduardo Fredkin, Michael Lawler, Oreto, and Yunah Kim. Okay, so this is a somewhat different perspective. Very quickly, just let me finish up. You could say, well, who cares? As Kivelson et al. Said, why worry about this spin density wave order? Maybe the pneumatic order, as suggested by Keimer's experiment, is the right order. Let's just work with that order. Forget about the spin density wave. Well, this at one level it makes it easy, but because that's just an Ising order parameter. This is literally the Wilson-Fisher theory. Aha, you say, great. These are the nodal fermions. Now these can couple very easily. And again, you get a coupling, which is exactly the coupling I had before. Rather, instead of having phi 1 squared minus phi 2 squared, I have phi. So you do have a Yukawa coupling. That's the nice thing about it. But as we saw many years ago, in fact, this is strongly relevant, but it flows off to infinity. We couldn't find any fixed point, suggesting a first order transition. Then Kivelson et al. Said, well, this has to be re-examined. Maybe it isn't. And so we have Yejin He and I have re-examined it. I don't have time. We did a 1 over n calculation, and we found that, in fact, there is a fixed point. And that fixed point is sort of an infinite anisotropy fixed point where this ratio of the velocity goes to zero. So we get some RG flow equation for the ratio of the velocity. This is very quick. I'm sorry. And this is the main prediction that comes out of this. Is that at low temperatures, at the critical point, this ratio of the velocities will go to zero as 1 over log t times log that number times log t. Okay. It's by far the most complicated prediction I've ever made. Anyway, so that can never be tested, but actually we can do a lot better. We can actually get numerically solve and get the whole function. So there is some temperature dependence of V delta over Vf that's predicted by the other theory. But it's very similar in spirit to the first theory, except it's a question of what is the primary order parameter. But they're both focusing on the pneumatic order as the dominant source of fluctuating coupling between these two degrees of freedom. And Yuna has also computed the spectral function of the fermions in this kind of theory, and you do get see these Fermi arc-like structures coming in very naturally. What happened? Oh, sorry. Little bug there. Okay, oops. All right, here it is. So these are the conclusions. The main problem that I hope I've convinced you is interesting is the question of the damping of nodal quasi-particle in STW. And I proposed sort of two different but closely related theories. And in both theories, what comes out is that the most important thing to worry about is this are these pneumatic, Ising pneumatic order parameters. That's what couples. That can couple very neatly to the nodal quasi-particles, and they can give you just the kind of language that I've seen, at least in near the quantum critical point. It'd be interesting to see if they disappear as away from, you know, not that close to 1/8 doping. Thank you.
Yeah. Would that
cut
out these
pneumatic
fluctuations?
It would. But it seems like, even YBCO anisotropy in the plane is relatively weak. It's all the plane. Yeah. If you get some in-plane anisotropy, that's more likely to influence things. Having the change doesn't seem to be enough, if I have to leave Keimer's interpretation.
In the recent neutron scattering work from the Hayden group, there's a second lower peak right in the middle of that lower branch of the.
Really? I see.
Do you have any ideas about that?
I haven't heard about that, so can you just enlighten me? Where is that?
Well, in addition to that, the resonance peak, which occurs where that comes together, halfway down at 20 millivolts, there's a strong peak that appears in the superconducting state, right?
Really? I don't know.
It's in that paper, Vignola, Nature, 07.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. I stole this from somebody else's talk. I haven't actually. Wait, I didn't look at that paper. right here.
No. On the branches.
Here.
Right there. Yes.
Oh, in addition to something here, there's something here.
No, nothing at the bottom. Just there, plus a 50.
That's fine. I mean, that in which material is this?
LSCO.
Optimal doping.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, that's fine. I mean, so this low energy part is only appears, you know, in the underdoped. YVCO looks like that too. You get something here and here. You don't see this part down here. This is the superposition of many different dopings, many different data, and many different samples also. There's a plot very much like this in transport as a view article where you surface the whole thing.
No, but if you plot the intensity as a function of energy.
Okay.
Local scattering
this way.
Cross section. Right.
Yeah. So you get a peak right here and a peak here.
Right.
Yeah, that's fine. That's exactly what you expect from this picture. My understanding is from looking at, well, just look at the main message in Trunkora's review article, where you surveys the whole thing and he has these plots, is that the difference between the different cuprates is the extent to which you see this downturn. I mean, almost all of them you see this upper energy part. I think everyone seems to agree on that. When do you see this lower part, and how far, how low does it go? In the LSCO, you can get all the way down to zero. In YVCO, you're somewhere else. You do see a little bit from this side. That's my understanding.
In fact, in terms of theories, I mean, it's very nice in terms of stripe theory. It explains this whole structure very, very elegantly. The way you think about it is the upper energy part, are if you take, especially if you take these bond center stripes, if you take these bond center stripes here, this one, then the high energy part are these triplon excitations moving along the stripes, and the low energy part of it is the spin density of order moving this in this direction. It just comes out very simply from the simplest model you can write down exactly.
Just a very naive question, going back to your quantum critical point and the damping going like E.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the other possible energy scale would be temperature, I guess.
Sure. So it's really max of E and T.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And is that seen, or does temperature make enough of a perturbation to the E that they can see some temperature dependence?
It's not in this data by the PSI group, but long back there was data from, Advocaten. My age, I keep forgetting.
Oh, Peter Johnson? Peter Johnson?
Peter Johnson, yes. Yeah, so I think they had linear temperature dependence. In photoelectric, I mean, you're talking about fairly high energies, actually.
That's why I was wondering whether the.
So E is always bigger than T.
Yeah.
So it's the larger of the two. Okay, so you'd have to go to very low energies to see the temperature dependence. So maybe you should scratch that comment. I don't think it is.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.